I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And it's on days like this that you wish prognosticators would get it wrong, but they didn't. As predicted, reports show the U.S. economy shrank over the last quarter. We're spending less, we're worth less, and the economy is contracting at an even faster clip than last year. In other words, our economic engines are stalling. Well, David Leonhardt says we'll land safely, but then what? David is a columnist for the New York Times. Today he's going to give us a peek into the economic future and also a sneak peek at his Sunday magazine cover story. It's titled The Big Fix, in which, David, you ask, what can President Obama do to transform an economy that can't count anymore on the two engines that we've just discovered are mirages? What are they?
Well, the two engines that are mirages are consumer spending and Wall Street, or at least they're partly mirages. Over the last two decades, consumer spending has gone from about 62, 63, 64% of our economy all the way up to 70%. That's far more than in other countries, and it's far more than it used to be here. That has happened in large part because of debt. People took out huge debts, often on their homes, to spend money. In essence, they spent tomorrow's money yesterday.
Right.
The second one is Wall Street. And look, there are a lot of things that Wall Street does that has value. If they are trying to figure out where to take $10 and invest it in the most productive ways, and they're deciding among biotechnology and steel and autos, and they make a decision and they're right about that, or they're right more often than they're wrong, then that has value. But if they're just moving money around in ways that doesn't actually move it to anything productive, which seems to have been in large part what they were doing, far more than we realized at the time, not just Bernie Madoff, but also all of these repackaging of mortgages, that has no value. And yet that boosted our GDP in the past. And so we're not going to have either of those things going forward.
And maybe we shouldn't, because as you said, it's kind of funny money.
We shouldn't, in fact. And that is a little bit of a silver lining here, which is we have been, in a funny way, wasting a lot of money, a lot of resources, not just money, but people as well. One of the things I mention in this magazine piece is that financial engineering, which is a field to teach you to go to Wall Street, became the largest engineering field for undergraduates at Princeton. It was bigger than mechanical engineering and chemical engineering and the other ones. And so we were putting lots of money and lots of people into things that it turns out weren't bringing any long-term benefit. So the bad news is we won't have that for economic growth. The good news is it probably wasn't all that real to begin with, and we can put it in more productive places.
And we want to hear what you say those are, but there's another silver lining here. You say that in a collapse like this, we can wipe out the interest groups that have sort of grown like barnacles around the economy.
Yeah, or at least we can take them on. I talk about a book by an economist named Mansur Olson that came out in the early 1980s. And what he did was he argued that very successful economies over time accumulate these interest groups that end up hurting the larger economy. The classic example would be a tariff, for example, a trade barrier. What that does is it helps the domestic manufacturer of a product, but it does so at the expense of all these consumers who must pay higher prices and have less of a selection of goods. When you have a crisis, it sort of smashes the old status quo, and it offers a chance to take on these interest groups.
You mentioned another one, home builders, real estate agents pushing for housing subsidies, made them rich, but of course then created this real estate bubble. And back to what happens going forward as, sort of the slate is almost wiped clean because of economic collapse. You have to create something, as you write, to be the new economic engines. And you remind us that in the past, after World War II, for instance, the economic engines of, housing and cars worked because we also invented suburbs and, people were buying houses that they didn't have, not just trading them, and people were buying their first cars. These were real engines.
Yes, and I would distinguish between two things here. One, the government played a vital role in creating that post-war economy, that booming post-war economy when the economy was growing more than 4% a year in the 50s and 60s, as opposed to in this past decade when even before this collapse it was growing at just 2.5%. The difference between 4 and 2.5 may not sound big, but it's actually enormous over a period of years. So the government played a vital role, and it's really pulled back. It hasn't made the kind of investments that it made in the past to build the highway system, to build the internet. Funding for the NIH hasn't kept pace with inflation in recent years, and so we built this great biotechnology industry, and now we're not doing as much to fund medical research. And so clearly the government needs to do more there. I don't think, however, that it needs to decide exactly what the industry of tomorrow is going to be. It needs to make a broad array of investments in education and alternative energy and healthcare and smart infrastructure and medical research and all these different things. And then the private sector will do a much better job at actually deciding and essentially what the industry of tomorrow will be.
Well, and we want to take a look, as you do, at that. But place us now. Give us your thoughts on the stimulus package passed in the House onto the Senate. You say that the lesson from past downturns is that governments have erred on the side of too much caution, you know, taking away the punch bowl, as you write, before the party really got going. What do you mean? Because you cite FDR, you cite different times in history.
Yeah. And in this part of the article, I quoted Tim Geithner, the new Treasury Secretary, who was actually in Japan for a good part, or at least the beginning of that country's struggles in recent decades. What you notice when you look at the Depression and when you look at Japan, and even when you look at last year with the way the Fed and the Bush administration responded, rarely in a serious financial crisis do you look back and say, wow, they overreacted. They did way too much. It's almost always the opposite. So in the middle part of the 30s, FDR had this little flirtation with fiscal discipline, and it had really bad effects. Keynes went to visit him and was distressed at how much FDR was wavering in terms of being aggressive.
John Maynard Keynes. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Japan clearly wavered and did all sorts of conflicting things. And then we think about last year. What's the thing that policymakers arguably made the biggest mistake on last year? And I think they regret it, even if they're not willing to admit it. They let Lehman Brothers fail. They don't regret bailing out companies at this point. They regret not being more aggressive.
And Tim Geithner was a top Federal Reserve official at that time.
That's right. That's right. And he and others have said that they didn't have legal authority to do it. But I think most people outside of the government don't quite believe that. And they think that if they had really wanted to do it, they could have done it. And not only that, but if they had to do it again, they would do it quite differently. And so one of the keys here with both the bailout and the stimulus is, can they just be continually aggressive, and can they maintain the political will to just take on this crisis again and again?
Spend money is pretty much what you're saying. Quickly, as you write, employing people to dig ditches, fill them up again would qualify. Any of the shovel-ready projects would be good. Spend money. But then, as you write, that's why it's so important to look into the future. What are going to be the economic engines that will then keep the economy flying after it's resuscitated and pay off that debt? So let's take a look ahead, because you say, for instance, people are talking about green jobs, and that's not as easy as it sounds.
It's not as easy as it sounds. So I want to be really clear about the fact that raising the cost of carbon is an urgent project. But it is not, as I say in the piece, a free lunch. It doesn't bring an economic windfall. And the reason is really quite simple when you think about it. To make alternative clean energy affordable, we have to raise the price of dirty energy. The reason we use oil and coal and electricity is that they're cheap. So the only way really to start using clean energy is to make that dirty energy more expensive. That is not, on net, fabulous for the economy. Yes, it will create green jobs, but it will also get rid of brown and gray jobs. And you have to look at both sides of the equation, and you can't just think that green jobs are the solution to our economic problems.
Well, but you write that the challenge on energy and green jobs is to rewrite the rules so that the private sector can start building one of tomorrow's big industries.
So the reality here is that we need to move away from dirty energy sources for reasons that have really nothing to do with economics, for reasons that have to do with the future of our planet and the world we will bequeath to our grandchildren, and also for political reasons, for funding these hostile foreign governments, whether it's Russia or in the Middle East. So given that we have to do that, we want to be one of the countries that funds some of this new alternative energy. We want to be the greener Saudi Arabia, as it were, the greener Venezuela, the greener Russia. And so we do want private industry to build that. We just shouldn't think that it's only an economic benefit.
Right. Well, you go on to say that perhaps another thing that should be looked at is the health industry. We know that Barack Obama wants to tighten it up, wants to put information online. But why is that possibly an economic engine?
Well, There are two different debates here that I think in the public discussion are just slightly off. They're not wrong, but I think the emphasis is slightly off. So the first is the debt. You know, if you ask people about the debt and the deficit, they'll say, oh, no, our debt and our deficit are completely unmanageable. And that's actually not true. Our debt-to-GDP ratio right now, which is the best way to look at it, is around 40-45%. It's probably going to go up to about 60 over the next year or so. But in the wake of World War II, it was above 100%. And those were some of the best economic decades that this country ever had. So our debts now will not prevent us from growing. However, the looming healthcare bill is so huge that it could prevent our economy from growing. The looming healthcare bill, the unfunded part of it, is something like 200% of GDP, 250% of GDP. It dwarfs everything else. And so we need to deal with these rising health costs. And we also need to deal with it for a second reason, which comes to the second misimpression. If we only do universal health care and don't get our costs under control, we will only make the cost problem worse. Whereas if we do get our cost problem, start to get it under control, we will make it much easier to afford universal health care and will make it much easier to have money to spend on other things.
So it seems as if you're saying that green jobs, although that might take a while, and a more efficient health care sector could be ways of imagining what our, you know, future economy might look like because they're concrete. You know, as you write, if somebody wonders what's going to replace Wall Street, what will replace housing, maybe, you know, healthcare and green jobs could be an answer. But to you, it seems like the overriding answer is education. You write, education helps a society leverage every other investment it makes because it appears to be the single best bet that a society can make.
That's right. I mean, I think what we need to build is an investment economy rather than a consumption economy. And I think an investment economy involves a whole range of investments like the ones we've been talking about. But I do think education is first among them. If you look at almost anything, you see incredible historical evidence for the benefits of education. You look at countries that have invested more in education, they've done far better. There's a fascinating book out that argues that the 20th century was the American century because this country had an enormous lead in educational attainment over the 20th century. We've lost that lead. If you look at states and say, why are they richer than their neighbors? Why is Minnesota richer than its neighbors? Well, Minnesota does a much better job educating its native students than its neighbors do. Why have Jews and Asian Americans been such successful immigrant groups? There are many reasons, but education is very, very high on the list. Those are two of the most educated immigrant groups we have. Why have women closed so much of the gap in pay with men over the last three decades? A decline in sexism is a big part of the reason, but women have also gotten vastly more educated over the last 30 years. Men are basically only slightly more educated than they were 30 years ago. So education is not a magic potion, but if you look over the course of history, there is no better bet than education.
Well, we'll have to have you back to talk about that, but in the meantime, you can see David Leonhardt's thoughts on the big fix, the future of the American economy, in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. It's the cover story. David, thanks as always for spending some time with us.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Welcome back. Well, we told you today's bad economic news. Earlier, the president weighed in on it.
The recession is deepening, and the urgency of our economic crisis is growing. Yesterday, we reached a new threshold, the highest number of Americans receiving unemployment benefits on record. Every day, it seems, there's another round of layoffs, another round of jobs lost, and families' lives turned upside down.
And another round of CEO bonuses. Yesterday, the president called Wall Street bankers shameful for taking home close to $20 billion in bonuses last year. And this week, a group of Harvard alums demanded that managers of the school's endowment, which has been shrinking, should return $21 million in bonuses. But can anything really change in the world of executive pay? Walden Asset Management is pushing companies to give shareholders more oversight of corporate pay. Tim Smith is senior vice president. And Tim, about 16 companies have so far agreed to take part in what you're calling Say in Pay programs. Tell us more.
This is a call that has gone out to the business community from investors for the last several years, asking them to provide an advisory vote for investors on executive pay every year. Just like we vote to ratify the auditors or elect the board, we believe that we should have the opportunity to vote not on the exact number that we're going to be paying the CEO, but on the overall pay package and philosophy. About 16 companies now have stepped forward, said they're willing to do it. Intel, Hewlett-Packard, and Occidental Petroleum most recently, but it shouldn't be a threat. And yet, interestingly enough, many companies and about 100 shareholder resolutions have been filed with companies asking for this advisory vote. And yet many companies are very reluctant to give shareholders any power over the executive compensation practice.
Well, Walt Disney and Apple are among those companies. They say compensation is too complicated for individual shareholders to understand.
Yes, it's complicated, but not so complicated that especially some of the big institutional investors in this country won't have very thoughtful feedback to provide. Shareowners want some checks and balances, and the citizens of this country want checks and balances on companies beyond government intervention.
And our question, too, is that these are also non-binding votes. So even if people are against the CEO pay packages, it's not binding. It doesn't matter.
Good point. So I think if there's an advisory vote that allows investors, small and large, to address the compensation issue, companies will get specific and immediate feedback on how investors think about this. I'll give you an example. A couple of years ago, Home Depot had this great scandal, of course, as Mr. Nardelli left with a huge pay package, and shareholders actually rose up and voted against the members of the compensation committee. And they got, I think, about a 35% no vote, which is pretty significant in this age. The compensation committee got to work. The next year, the new CEO had a very different pay package and a very different philosophy represented in the executive compensation. They listened.
Well, we understand part of the thinking is that even though it's not binding, there's a certain, perhaps shame to knowing that all of your shareholders are upset with you. Although, people, scanning the landscape in the last year say some of these CEOs have no shame.
Well, and exactly right. I think you can say both and. The shame factor has not been successful in the past in many cases, and that is why it's the president is right. Some of these pay packages are shameful. But numerous companies are listening to this debate on pay. They are changing. This is a year that many companies didn't provide bonuses, and many other companies changed their pay philosophy. We can't generalize and say business doesn't listen or business is totally responsive when they hear these public debates. Some companies act shamelessly and will just give huge pay packages while shareholder value is going to hell in a handbasket and while employees are being laid off. Others of them are very sensitive to the fact that they need to, at the top executive level, share in the pain.
Well, what are you hearing from Washington that you either like or don't like? Treasury Secretary Geithner said at his confirmation hearings that rules are being prepared regarding executive pay packages. The TARP program was supposed to have restrictions on executive pay. What are you hearing?
Yes, I think the whole executive pay issue is in this week entered a brand new phase. And we are going to see, I think, much more government focus far beyond our advisory vote on pay. We did see a discussion about clawbacks. In other words, if compensation was provided based on false numbers, that the bonuses should be retrieved from executives. We've seen even debates about caps on pay or how much pay should be allowed to be tax exempt. We've certainly seen debate, haven't we, about perks like corporate airplanes. So there will be much more debate, not only in the Congress, but among investors and among boards of directors about what their proper approach should be on executive compensation.
As far as legislating some of this, you tried to get through Congress legislation about say-in-pay programs, the right of shareholders to have a vote in executive pay, and it passed the House, but it didn't pass the Senate. This was in 2007.
That's correct. It didn't get brought up to the Senate, although then Senator Obama was the champion of it, and Senator McCain also supported it.
Well, that was going to be my question. Given that Senator Obama was behind your bill a year ago, do you have a feeling that you might be able to get that legislation now?
Yes, we feel it's almost inevitable that the advisory vote will pass the Congress. And in fact, most companies we talk to observe that that will happen. Interestingly enough, both Hewlett-Packard and Occidental Petroleum said they supported this legislation, so they didn't think it was something they should oppose.
Well, you do act as an advocate for shareholders, but what about small investors who don't have real votes? How can they influence the way executives are paid?
Well, you know, all of us who have shares, and we have them in pension funds and IRAs and so on, are participating in this economic system and are participating in the pain right now. Individual investors, smaller investors, can do a couple of things. One, if they own shares in a specific company like Disney, or if they own shares in Goldman Sachs, they can vote for this resolution. Of course, as citizens, they can write their members of Congress and say, we support you taking aggressive measures on pay. And finally, they can ask the mutual funds that they're investing in to be proactive, too. And that's not such a long shot. A lot of mutual funds are voting much more thoughtfully on corporate governance issues because their job is to protect investors' interests. Many institutional investors see the advisory vote on pay as a fair and reasonable approach and are encouraging companies to do it.
Tim Smith, Senior Vice President of Walden Asset Management, talking about executive pay. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Okay, still ahead today, in his own words, the late artist Andrew Wyeth. That's after the latest news here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's been quite a time of loss in American culture, hasn't it? Author John Updike this week, artist Andrew Wyeth earlier this month at 91. Well, today we want to catch our breath a little and reflect on the life of Andrew Wyeth. You can probably picture his work. There's Christina's World, a woman in a common kitchen dress stretched out in a field. Wind from the Sea, a tattered lace curtain blowing in across an old window. Wyeth was the son of famed illustrator N.C. Wyeth. He's also the father of artist Jamie Wyeth. He painted in the old family homestead in Chadsford, Pennsylvania, and up in his studio in Maine. In the 40s, he was heralded as a dark, radical, almost surrealist, then later dismissed by some critics as mere dorm room poster art when the abstractionists like Jackson Pollock came along. But Thomas Hoving remained steadfast. In 1976, as director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Hoving mounted a Wyeth retrospective, conducted one of the few interviews with Wyeth, wrote three books on him, and ultimately became a friend. What a perfect person to bring into our conversation about Andrew Wyeth. Although we should warn you, Thomas Hoving can be as salty and blunt as our subject. Thomas, welcome.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. And how are you? Because this was not just a subject for you, this was a friend.
He was a dear friend and could twig me, and I could twig him, so we were two twiggers.
Well, you're also very much on the record. You say you admired Andrew Wyeth, but for all the wrong reasons.
Well, a lot of people who've been writing about him since he passed say that he was starchily sentimental. And my take on Andrew Wyeth was he'd never made a sentimental painting or drawing in his life. He was a son of a bitch who painted son of a bitches, including me. And he painted the way a surgeon cuts into you. And that is no feeling about it. Just cut and get it and throw it out. And post-operative pains, that's your problem. And he had this vicious knife-like eye that captured things and delivered them to humanity in a way that I don't think many artists in history have done.
Well, and you've told me it's because of his eyesight.
Well, he had a fantastic vision and could see very close and far away, 20/10 or whatever, the finest pilots in the world have it. And he said that's part of his success. But remarkably, the fine single brush, if there is such a thing, detail, did not overwhelm the overall subject matter. His finest things, I think, that will go down in history are the watercolors. The tempera was a very personal medium for him. He liked to hold it and feel it because it was this marvelous thing, like the building of the surface of the earth, he used to tell me. But the watercolors, these fast, swooping, incredible pieces, I think are going to become more and more famous as years go on.
Well, you also write, you're the only person he talked to about his paintings?
Joe Levine, who was a Hollywood mogul, had a great collection of his paintings. And back in the days when I was at the Met, Joe said, well, I'll give you my entire collection if you put a show of Wyeth's works on. And I said, done, kid. Mm-hmm. You know. And I asked Henry Geltzahler, very trendy, chic curator of contemporary, would he do the show? And he went down and met Wyeth and began to look through the pre-studies, which nobody had ever seen except Wyeth and his wife, Betsy. And Henry Geltzahler, who was this most modern pop art guy, Andy Warhol guy, fell in love with Wyeth's work. But then he said, I've got to pull out. I said, what? He said, I got to pull out because my clique won't like it. And I said, well, I guess I better do it. And instead of a catalog, which I think is kind of dull, let me go down and talk to him about what the heck he's been doing. So I went down in his father's studio. I said, let's talk only about art. I don't care about your family or you or anybody. He said, nobody's ever said that. He opened up a bottle of red wine at 9 in the morning, and we went on from there.
Yep. Well, as you're well aware, I found out firsthand how much Andrew Wyeth didn't like to do interviews. I got my interview by looking up Wyeth in the main phone book. His wife answered and said, come up. And we went to a studio on Southern Island. But he had no interest in talking, as you'll hear. And apologies for the sound. This is an old television special from the mid-'80s. It features the interview and pictures of Maine, which you won't see. And you also won't see that as soon as we arrived, Wyeth says he doesn't want to do it. It's going to get all sentimental and mushy. So I ask him about that, and almost immediately he gets up, and I have to haul him back by his microphone cord.
Well, tell me again about that thought, about the reason you don't want to do that much of this, besides that it makes it all sentimental and mushy. And
no, I don't think it makes it sentimental. I think it's a bloody bore.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wyeth. But what do you want to talk about? You tell me.
You sit in this chair. Let me interview you.
Well, you do it from right there. What do you want to know?
Are you married?
No.
God, what happened to you?
Well, I think he was captivated by you, kiddo. He loved gals.
Well, but you know,
did he ever ask you to pose in a nude for him?
No, that didn't happen.
He asked my wife. Years later, she said, that was the stupidest thing I ever did. Not posing in the nude for him.
Yeah, well, in fact, he did keep things close even from you. You told me that the famous Helga paintings from the mid-'80s, this is the woman from Chad's Ford, Wyeth painted for over 15 years, often in the nude. His wife, Betsy, when she was asked what they were about, said, love, which triggered all sorts of, you know, excitement in the press that perhaps there was romance. But nobody knew about these paintings except...
But my wife knew about them. He told her and kept telling her. He would go into places in Chatsford and in Maine, and he would paint in people's attics and leave things there. And I'll bet you in 20 years or so, people will find stuff.
But why didn't your wife tell you about that?
Because Andrew said, don't tell us all.
Huh.
I was running a magazine at the time. I said, well, thanks for telling me. I could have done an exclusive on this. She said, well, he told me not to tell anybody.
It was part of his reclusiveness, perhaps anger at critics who said he was a mere illustrator?
Not in the slightest. We used to laugh about his critics, and his favorite critic who hated him was a fellow by the name of Hilton Kramer, and he wrote that all of Andrew's colors were the color of merde. And Andy said, you know, why can't he come out and say shit? You know? What is this guy so effete he can't even say the American word to the... He really left like hell about that.
I talked to as much as I could to Andrew Wyeth about the idea that people, you know, completely misunderstood the thought that they too could drive to Maine and capture the same images he did. Let's listen.
They're so carried away by the scenic beauty of this state, they'd probably be better and paint stay down in Hoboken, New Jersey, and paint their sink. I don't think. People that come up here to Maine will become great writers of Maine or great painters of Maine because of Maine. I think it's got to be within your soul. I may go to some obscure place. I may be in the middle of the street of Rockland painting. If you know my work well, it's quite fleeting, a lot of it is. And it's sort of rags and tatters. Well, take Wind from the Sea. They're all sort of scudding things. They may be quiet subjects, but there's motion in the quietness. I'm not completely honest, even my work. I mean, my subjects are fleeting things. Sometimes they don't even exist.
But Christina does.
Oh, she did. Yes.
Yeah.
But she was never in the field, for instance.
Andrew Wyeth from our interview in the mid-'80s. Speaking of Christina Olsen, the Maine woman he painted so much, you're listening to Here and Now. Thomas Hoving, tell us about Christine Olsen. Maybe one of Wyeth's most famous images is of this farm woman in a kitchen dress laying in the field looking up at her house on the hill. Who was she?
Well, let me add first that one of his famous paintings, one of his really best paintings, is of a sink. at Turner's Farm, the sink where this milk bucket, looking like a shining silver parade armor for some great monarch in the Middle Ages, is just sitting on the edge of this huge farm sink.
Right.
Christina was a gal. She had a serious illness when she was young, and she could hardly get around. She was very ugly. She was very beautiful in her eyes. They really got along together magnificently. He said, people think there's this young girl crawling around in the grass, looking up at her house. He said, they have no idea that she's this old crippled person.
No.
And some of the best pictures he ever did were of her and her brother, who was equally startling looking.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to Wyeth talking about putting Christine, placing her in his painting in the field that she couldn't get to.
This is what she wanted to be. People were finally bothered that I painted her face, and they found that she was rather a very powerful-looking woman that we wouldn't call obviously beautiful. I thought she was. And I probably it was a mistake, because people had many ideas of that she would look like Emily Dickinson, you know, or something. People love to have their own imagination.
Thomas Hoving, Andrew Wyeth painted you. So what was that like?
I went down in Father's studio, and he made me talk for the entire 38 hours. And it's hot, about maybe 107 in the studio. And he sits on his tiny little stool on the floor, and he begins to take off his clothes to stay cool, and I'm forced to keep mine on. I'm sweating, and I'm talking. He says, I want to hear more. You got to keep talking, because that's for animation. And he looked at my nostril and said, that is the basis of all the proportions that I'm going to do of you. When I do a human being, I don't do a forearm, I don't do a finger. Everybody's nostril is different from everybody else's, and it's in proportion with everything else in their body.
Huh.
So he spent a great deal of time on my nostril. And at the end of the first session, the first weekend, I said, can I take a look at it? And he said, I've never shown anything in my life that's uncompleted. And I said, come on, for God's sake. He said, oh, take a look. And there was my father. And he had never seen my father in his life. And, of course, it was the bone structure of the Hoving family that he had captured. And at the very end, he says, you know, just around now, I can wreck these things. And I said, stop, finish it, do it. You know, and he did, handed it to me. And then he told me some marvelous stories that one of his dogs, Nell, she was outside looking at him through the big window of the studio, and a squirrel was coming down a tree just behind her, and then suddenly she turns around, grabs the squirrel, and kills it, because she was looking in the glass as a mirror. He said, I didn't know dogs could see things in a mirror. He loved the cruel. He loved blood. He you know, the only other painter that I ever knew was Francis Bacon, who said he used to get on the British police band and hear about automobile accidents, and he'd go out and take a look at the blood.
Huh. Well,
artists are weird, kiddo.
Well, the plants in his paintings are dead. The people are most often poor. You still wonder, where did the sentimental thing come from?
The sentimental thing comes from the copyists, the would-bes, the wannabe Andrew Wyeths. And a couple of summers ago, on his 90th birthday, I had lunch with him up in Maine. And he said, gosh, a guy I really like came in with a watercolor of a house in Maine. I said, Andy, this is one of your pictures. It was given to so-and-so who gave it to me, but you never signed it. And Andy says to me, he said, it was this really piece of junk, you know, kind of a copy wannabe Wyeth. He said, so I signed it for him. I said, how many of those have you done? He said, oh, a couple of dozen. So the PhDs in the future are going to be convoluted.
Thomas Hoving, we'll link you to his essays on Andrew Wyeth at artnet.com, at our website here-now.org, where you'll also find the paintings and a photograph we took on our visit to Maine. But we're going to take a break and come back with just a few more thoughts on Andrew Wyeth from Thomas Hoving, here and now. Welcome back. We're speaking with Thomas Hoving, the former director of New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art and currently an art critic at artnet.com. We're talking about his friend Andrew Wyeth, who died this month at 91. And Thomas, you've been telling us stories about Wyeth's keen eyesight, his dog. Do you have others?
He also told me that in the vault in his bank in Wilmington, Delaware, there is a unfinished portrait of Richard Nixon. And that Nixon, about 3 months after he was forced to resign, got in touch with Wyeth and said, I want you to do my portrait. And the face is pretty well finished. And it looks ravaged because Nixon at that point was beaten down. And he said to Wyeth, I want you to do this, and I want you to do this portrait with me looking like this, because for sure that will be the top portrait in the National Portrait Gallery. And then he never showed up again, never asked for the picture, and it's in the vault, far as I know.
Well, I know you have your books there with Wyeth's thoughts. Combine his words with yours. What do you think his best work is?
What do I think is his best work? I think his watercolor called Wolf Moon, done in 1975, is his best work and one of the best watercolors ever made in the United States. I was up there late one night in back of the Kerner House about 1 o'clock in the morning. The moon was full and illuminated the melted patches of snow on the hill in a mysterious way. Suddenly I heard a soft, regular sound from the woodshed. It was Anna Kerner chopping wood late at night. There was only one light on in the whole house, and that was at the woodshed. God, I can still hear this chopping sound, chopping the kindling fine, very fine, putting it into a small basket to start the early morning breakfast fire. I stood there in the crisp, chill moonlight in trance. Finally, she stopped. The light in the woodshed went out, and I saw other lights go out in different windows. She went upstairs, turning them off on her way up. And then there was a silence, and only the moon and the still house below and the great expanse of the hill above it with the patches of half-melted snow on the hill. It's in their private collection. It's just totally out of sight.
Well, let's close with a few more thoughts from Andrew Wyeth. Here's what he thinks the Wyeth legacy will be, despite some critics.
I think, of course, very strongly that we're, both Jamie and I, are much further out than what's being done. I honestly feel that way.
Is it partially because it was successful and that's a no-no?
Well, yes, of course that. The fact that it has a commercial value, there's a jealousy about that.
That bother you at all?
Not the slightest bit. I don't think a painting's good just because it sells, though.
What makes it good?
I think it's just the spirit, the quality that makes the person that comes across a painting stop. He may not buy it right away, but he goes home and he thinks about it and he can't get it out of his thoughts. Mm. That's what it is.
How do you choose who you choose to put in your pictures, the rags and tatters that you pick?
I don't know. I suppose it begins with, as Robert Frost said, a poem begins with a lump in the throat. Or with me, my hair rising in the back of my head. It's the spirit of a thing that you can't get rid of.
How do you make sure that it isn't, that you get that spirit, that it isn't just a painting of a window?
Well, you can tell very quickly whether your hand is shaking, shivering, whether you're excited. If it becomes dead and it doesn't stimulate you or make you forget meals and everything else. You see, I've always said I wish I didn't have to be there when I'm painting. I hate myself for being in the way. I hope that when I die, my spirit will come back and I can paint.
But you're the vessel through which it goes.
No, no, I'm sitting there and I got hair and mess. I don't care about my own life. That's unimportant. Have I made a statement that's valid? That we don't know.
Thomas Hoving, I think you would say to your friend Andrew Wyeth that we do know what he did count it. I would sort of say.
Oh, I happen to know what he did count it. Yeah. It's counted very big.
Yeah. Thomas Hoving, thanks so much for your time.
Okay.
Well, football fans, and probably a lot of people who watch only maybe a game a year, are gearing up for Sunday's Super Bowl. The 43rd edition of Pro Football's title tilt features the Pittsburgh Steelers going for their 6th Super Bowl win and the Arizona Cardinals playing in a big game for the first time. And it is a big game. Big, big, big. Sports biggest. So why are we seeing the word subdued in a headline. Patrick Johnson is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He's in Florida. And Patrick, your headline is the one that says, Tampa welcomes fans to the Subdued Bowl. The Subdued Bowl. Someone should take that on in the future. But what do you mean? What are you seeing?
Well, this is my first Super Bowl, so it's a little hard for me to imagine as far as actually having been there before. But when you actually look at some of the revenue estimates that firms like PricewaterhouseCoopers and others have done, they've basically revised them downward pretty dramatically, 20% in this case. And you're really seeing it, too, as far as, you know, there's just not a lot of activities, not a lot of parties so far, and it's mostly Steelers fans in town because Arizona is a much smaller franchise. Everybody's super psyched, of course, back in Phoenix, but we're just not seeing a lot of Cardinals fans here. I think it would have been a different story, and I think a lot of business leaders here would have loved to have seen a Philly-Steelers matchup.
Well, a couple things. Apparently, first of all, we're understanding that people in Arizona are still, you know, getting over the shock that they're in, so maybe they didn't realize
Absolutely.
The next step was to go, but they still can go. We understand you can still get tickets.
Well, absolutely, and in fact, that's another thing that scalpers are saying is that it's possible on game day to get tickets still, probably for less than the face value, which is around $800. So, you know, they can definitely come on down.
Right,
they should be able to find some tickets.
I was hearing this morning that, you know, back in the day in a big game, you could get $10,000 for a ticket. So certainly they're, you know, somewhat of a deal now. And you were saying, you know, some of the parties aren't happening. We understand Playboy, Sports Illustrated, Victoria's Secret usually have swanky parties, you know, before the game, but they're sitting this year out. And you spoke with a T-shirt vendor. What was he saying?
This is a guy who travels around. His company goes to all big events like Super Bowls and sets up, you know, T-shirt shops. And he set up in Ybor City, which is one of the party spots in Tampa. And on Tuesday night, he was basically not seeing anyone out in the street. There were a few parties around, but not a lot of people on the street. And he said, you know, the party should have started over the weekend. And so he's not seeing it. He's a little disappointed, although he was more worried about the people who had bought lots of merchandise because his stock was a little smaller, so he wasn't too worried. He figured he'd be able to move it this weekend, but yeah, he was nervous. That's what he told me.
Well, but yeah, we should say, when you say PricewaterhouseCoopers shifted the revenue estimates, it was from $180 million to $150 million. So this
Correct.
Is still, you know, sport's biggest game.
Don't get me wrong. This is huge for the city. A lot of cities would have loved to have this event, of course, and it's less ostentatious, and I think part of that's deliberate, too, on the part of the NFL with the economy. I don't think, you know, there's not going to be any champagne fountains and things like that. It's a little bit less ostentatious, not quite so brash
as
past years.
And maybe that's appropriate. Maybe this is what a Super Bowl should look like in a recession. Patrick Johnson, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in Tampa for the Super Bowl. Patrick, thanks.
Okay, Robin.
Well, the Super Bowl can't be too downsized. Bruce Springsteen is the halftime performer.
Out here the nights are long, the days are lonely. I think of you, I'm working on a dream.
That's Working on a Dream, the title song from Bruce Springsteen's latest CD. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. If you watch the game, whatever you do this weekend, have a great one. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.